Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Roger Hickey of the Campaign for America's Future, who assesses President Bush's stated foreign and domestic policy agenda for his second term in the White House. And Jokey Jehu, director of the 50 Years is Enough Network, who reports on the 5th annual World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, where more than 100,000 progressive activists from around the globe met to discuss how to achieve a more just world. And Barry Bachrach, attorney for Native American activist and political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who discusses efforts currently underway to free his client. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The new International Criminal Court is at the center of what the United Nations will do about the war crimes committed in the Darfur district of Sudan. The 176-page UN report on the abuses in Darfur calls for the International Criminal Court, or the ICC, to investigate gross violations of human rights. The UN Security Council is debating the question of whether to send the matter to the ICC, a move opposed by the Bush administration. The UN report came under strong criticism from civil society groups for not declaring that genocide had occurred in Darfur. However, the report details human rights abuses in the war-torn area. In maintaining its crusade against the ICC, the Bush administration has requested that an ad hoc tribunal be created to investigate war crimes in Darfur. Yet the ICC is already fully functioning with money and staff and has the endorsement of the European Union and Canada. As Richard Dicker of Human Rights Watch told the online magazine OneWorld.net, the Bush administration seems willing to sacrifice Darfur's victims to its ideological campaign against the court. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has called for swift prosecution of Sudanese officials and the militias committing war crimes in Darfur. Annan insisted the individuals involved, who are named in the UN report, must be brought to justice. Thus far, the continuing violence in Darfur has resulted in the killing of 70,000 people and displaced 2 million others from their homes. At the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, 20 American female interrogators engaged in sexually suggestive conduct designed to break fundamentalist Muslim detainees who follow strict religious practices forbidding physical contact between men and women other than between a man and his own wife or family member. According to the Associated Press, in November 2003, the American military admitted that a female interrogator took off her uniform shirt in front of an Islamic detainee. Wearing a brown T-shirt, she ran her fingers through the inmate's hair and then sat on his lap. Some of the Muslim detainees already released from Guantanamo Bay have complained of being harassed by so-called prostitutes. In recent weeks, the FBI has criticized the sexual touching of prisoners by the female interrogators at Guantanamo Bay in a letter stating that U.S. defense officials had not acted on complaints by FBI observers. Inside the detention center, there were reports of an all-female team of interrogators who worked for the immediate reaction force to subdue unruly prisoners. The scandal-plagued Riggs Bank of Washington, D.C. has admitted to its role in permitting money laundering by two major bank clients, former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet and top officials of Equatorial Guinea and West Africa, who were the target of a failed coup plot that involved Mark Thatcher, son of the former British Prime Minister. According to the Washington Post, Riggs pled guilty to failing to file suspicious activity reports and agreed to pay a $16 million fine if approved by a judge. In court papers, the 160-year-old bank admits that it helped Pinochet, the subject of a war crimes inquiry, to hide millions of dollars from investigators. The former dictator is now under house arrest in Chile, where investigators are looking into Riggs' role in hiding his wealth. In 1995, Equatorial Guinea, a repressive West African country run by President Teodoro Obiang Nguema, became a bank client after oil was discovered. The oil-rich nation of 500,000 people soon became Riggs' biggest client with $700 million in deposits. Riggs now says it failed to file reports of suspicious transactions involving Obiang, his family, and other top officials. Left out of the settlement were Riggs' dealings with top Saudi Arabian diplomats, including Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. and a friend of the Bush family. However, sources say federal prosecutors have found no evidence the Saudi bank transactions were illegal. Finally, we wish to note the passing of Ozzie Davis, who died on February 4th. Mr. Davis, who along with his wife Ruby Dee had a successful career in film and theater, was also known as a man who lived by his principles. Throughout his career, Ozzie Davis stood up for workers' rights. He and his wife were scrutinized in the McCarthy era of the 50s for their fundraising and outspokenness against racial injustice and for trying to open up the entertainment industry. Most recently, Mr. Davis spoke out strongly against the U.S.-led war in Iraq. We say goodbye to a courageous fighter and pioneer who left behind a legacy of achievement and activism. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After winning a narrow victory in the November 2004 election, President Bush set out an audacious set of foreign and domestic policy goals in his State of the Union address and his administration's budget proposal. In his State of the Union speech, Mr. Bush gloated about the higher-than-expected turnout in the Iraqi election and threatened the nations of Iran and Syria, demanding they comply with Washington's blueprint for a democratic transformation of the Middle East. On the domestic front, the president made many questionable declarations about the imminent demise of the Social Security system, while proposing that the nation follow his prescription of moving toward costly partial privatization of the popular New Deal-era program. In his administration's 2006 budget proposal, Mr. Bush put forth a plan that would eliminate or deeply cut programs benefiting veterans, food stamp recipients, students, and farmers, while increasing funding for the Pentagon. The dramatic cuts were said to be part of a plan to reduce record deficits amassed during the president's first term in office. But much of the country greeted Mr. Bush's audacious agenda with skepticism, noting that with the U.S. tied down in a bloody guerrilla war in Iraq, threats made against Iran and Syria were mere empty gestures. And although solutions to long-range shortfalls in Social Security and current budget deficits could easily be addressed with a rollback of the president's tax cuts primarily benefiting the rich, these obvious resolutions were willfully ignored. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, who takes a critical look at the president's agenda and the strategies being discussed to oppose his policies.
Well, it's really ironic that the president claims to be a champion of democracy around the world, and he also claims to be pursuing terrorism systematically and effectively. That's probably the one issue that got him elected, was the claim that he's a fighter against the forces of terrorism. But in reality, what he has done and continues to do is stir up massive reaction to the United States and to even the notion of democracy, especially in the Middle East, where he has spent the treasure and the blood of American soldiers in a really ill-considered adventure. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There were no imminent threats to the United States at all. And Osama bin Laden is never mentioned in his speeches anymore because the full force of the U.S. military is focused on maintenance operation in Iraq and threatening countries like Iran and others. The neocons around Bush have created a mess. It's costing enormous amounts of money in terms of the federal budget, and it is amazing to see them trying to package this mess as a crusade for democracy. It's far from it.
Roger Hickey, in looking at the Bush administration's proposed budget specifics, deep cuts, elimination of some programs, the Bush administration seems to be targeting all these programs for the poor and disadvantaged. And they justify it by saying that this is an effort to reduce the deficit. Make any sense to you?
It makes a lot of sense. They have, on purpose, created this deficit. When the Bush administration came into office, there were large surpluses. We were actually paying down our debt, and we had money to think about attacking poverty in children and other noble causes, fixing Social Security. In fact, they have systematically created this federal deficit by cutting taxes for the very wealthy. And these tax cuts now have given us a massive problem, a problem that the president is now addressing by slashing in the budget. It's health care for young children that is on the chopping block. It's nutrition programs. It's education. This president claims to be an education president. He temporarily increased spending for education while he was trying to get No Child Left Behind passed. And now education in this budget is targeted for steady reductions. This plays very, very well to Bush's Republican hardcore supporters, especially the very wealthy. But this is a budget that is going to hurt the middle class. It's going to be a bloody battle. If the Republicans stay together, they may have the votes to pass it. And then on top of this budget cutting, Bush will then try to extend the tax cuts for the very wealthy and make them permanent. And so you're going to see additional holes blown into the federal budget for the out years, as they call them. And then you have the Social Security privatization plan, which all experts estimate is going to cost $2 trillion in transition costs over the next 10 years. Those are major, major impacts on the federal revenue, which this budget does not take into account. It's quite a mess.
Roger Hickey, as you survey the Democrats and other opposition voices out there, what are the chances that the country is going to respond effectively to defeat this agenda, whether it be the foreign policy agenda, the privatization of Social Security, these deep cuts in the federal budget?
Well, I do think that on foreign policy, the president has gotten a shot of the arm in terms of the election. Polling shows that people are feeling a little bit better about the Iraqi adventure. But that's not going to last long if the Bush administration does not figure out an exit strategy. And I think there will be continued calls, as Ted Kennedy called for just the other day, a plan to remove our troops from the Middle East and from Iraq. And this is similar to the Vietnam War when Nixon tried to Vietnamize the Vietnam War. More and more members of Congress are joining with the average people in the street in saying, let's see a plan for withdrawal. In terms of the domestic bloodbath that is the federal budget, just about every group that you can imagine, every organized civic association and group that represents working families is engaged in trying to stop the cuts. I think there will be victories against the Bush budget, although the Republicans have the votes, if they stand united, to pass pretty much whatever they want. And I think the one place where the Bush administration is going to find their Waterloo this year is going to be on this plan to privatize Social Security. The Republicans are divided. The Democrats are united in opposition to privatization. There is hope, and there is a likelihood that Bush is going to see his winning streak broken and turned around.
That was Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Contact the campaign by calling area code 202-955-5665 or visit their website at www.ourfuture.org. Now in its fifth year, the World Social Forum returned to its birthplace in Porto Alegre, Brazil this year after moving to Mumbai, India in 2004. The gathering of progressive activists drew more than 100,000 delegates to this year's event held January 26th through the 31st. The World Social Forum began in 2001 as a way to counter the agenda of the World Economic Forum convened annually in Davos, Switzerland. While business and political leaders in Switzerland discuss how free markets and corporations will address international economic and development issues, delegates to the World Social Forum advocate for structural reforms to eliminate poverty, environmental destruction, and social injustice. As a testament to the success of the World Social Forum, many delegates in Davos this year echoed some of the same concerns long focused on by their progressive counterparts in Brazil. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Njoki Jehu, director of the 50 Years is Enough Network, who just returned from the World Social Forum. She summarizes some of the issues considered at this year's global summit.
In 2001, the World Social Forum had been founded with this wonderful theme and this sort of dream and vision of another possible world, one where people are resisting and fighting and creating alternatives to trickle-down economics, to neoliberalism, to privatization of water and health services and education, etc., where people are fighting, really fighting and struggling to be able to determine their own future. And the first World Social Forum, there was an expectation of maybe 5,000 people coming to that event, and they ended up being closer to 20,000. This was in 2001. I just returned last Wednesday from the fifth edition of the World Social Forum. There was 150,000 people who participated in the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil this year. The opening march of the World Social Forum 2005 had 200,000 people participating. So it's a very vibrant space where even when you hear 150,000 people coming, it's even more amazing when you understand that those people come, they register to organize all kinds of activities, the so-called self-organized activities. It's very inspiring to be there, you know, in a space where, for instance, English is not the dominant language, and the issues that our people are raising are issues that connect people's struggles, even though different, but somehow connected and related to each other. And that's really powerful, and it's a wonderful and powerful experience to be part of.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, what you bring back from Porto Alegre and the topics that were discussed. I mean, the priorities of the people gathered there, if you can put a finger on that, and, you know, the possible action that could work through this gathering in Porto Alegre.
Perhaps the most tangible example of what comes out of this World Social Forum process and experience is the February 15, 2003 worldwide rallies and marches against war in Iraq. And although 10 million people plus around the world in over 600 cities came together and said no to the Bush agenda and to the war, but the war went ahead. It was a very powerful and, you know, so far unique activity that had happened where people around the world had come together on the same day to raise a specific issue. And I think this is sort of the model of where in creating alternatives and articulating alternatives, people can speak and manifest those alternatives that they articulate and imagine. In Porto Alegre, I learned that in Uruguay, they had a referendum where they defined and agreed that water was a right, not a need, not a service, but a right, an entitlement to every person. We hear that in Argentina, they have similar referendum in the works. And this is what is so inspiring. So even as people in Soweto, South Africa, are fighting against water privatization and prepaid water meters look like they're the wave of the future, you have this fight back and these victories in places like Uruguay. And that's where, you know, I go for inspiration. It's where I go to really hear that all is not lost, even despite the bad news that comes from all kinds of places, you know, from the re-election of George Bush to, you know, the war in Darfur to the tsunami in South Asia, et cetera, et cetera. That all is not lost. There is spaces where good things are happening and where people are fighting and winning.
The World Social Forum, over its 5 years, has been criticized internally in some respects by some who say it's really should have more tangible action coming out of these large conferences of hundreds of thousands of people. Do you see any movement towards a different way of debating and coming up with action plans?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the challenges that we have as people who are imagining a different world and a different way of doing and being in the world is to accept that in order for something to have value and to be recognized, it doesn't have to be huge and to be at the macro level. It can be at the micro level and still have value and still have impact. And I talked about the February 15, 2003 demonstrations against the war. But there's so many other things that are happening that don't get the recognition. It's the old joke, I don't know, about if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a noise? That there's real work happening and there are real exchanges happening, and people are talking about the similarities and the struggles around trade issues, around international debt, around workers' rights, around women's rights, you know, the fight against fundamentalism. So I think that this is one of the challenges that we have to have, both within and outside the WSF process, that just because we don't know about it doesn't mean it's not happening. And two, just because it's not happening involving tens of thousands or everyone who is at the World Social Forum doesn't mean it doesn't have value or that it is not having an impact.
That was Njoki Jehu, director of the 50 Years is Enough Network. Contact the network by calling area code 202-463-2265 or visit their website at www.50years.org. February 6th marked the beginning of Native American activist Leonard Peltier's 30th year behind bars. Peltier was convicted of murdering two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in June 1975. The incident was made famous in fiction and nonfiction films and Peter Matheson's book In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. It took place during a state of siege on the reservation when the federal government collaborated with a corrupt tribal government against Indians observing a traditional way of life with the support of members of the American Indian Movement, or AIM. After the confrontation, Peltier fled to Canada, where he was extradited based on perjured testimony back to the U.S. Two others charged in the murders of the FBI agents were acquitted based on a claim of self-defense. Peltier's trial was rife with government misconduct, which later came to light in documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, although several thousand documents are still being withheld. His supporters waged an intensive campaign to convince former President Bill Clinton to grant Peltier clemency, but the outgoing Democratic president declined to do so. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Peltier's lawyer, Barry Bachrock, who discusses efforts currently underway to free his client.
Well, we went in 2003 before the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and here's an exact quote from the court, quote, "Much of the government conduct on the Pine Ridge Reservation and in the prosecution of Mr. Peltier is to be condemned. The government withheld evidence. It coerced witnesses. These facts are undisputed." That's an exact quote from the 10th Circuit, yet they throw their hands up and say, but what can we do? And, you know, my challenge is, if the court system isn't going to correct government misconduct, which is acknowledged as early as 1986, when the Eighth Circuit had the evidence that the government withheld been before the jury, it could have caused the jury serious concerns as to whether Leonard was guilty, and yet they don't give him a new trial. It leaves me as an attorney scratching my head, because I always considered that you had to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We have several actions pending throughout the country to get the FBI to produce the 140,000 documents they're still withholding and begrudgingly giving us. And we're going to keep pushing that. We also have an action for Leonard under the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984. The bottom line is Leonard has been illegally incarcerated since 1993, at least. Since in 1984, the Congress, because of the arbitrary and capricious decisions of the Parole Commission, basically gave the Parole Commission 5 years to set firm release dates for all prisoners in custody by October 12, 1989, which it never did. And the Parole Commission was supposed to become extinct as of October 12th of 1989. But as we see today, the Parole Commission, despite the congressional enactments of that time continues to exist, and there's several issues involved in that case that are technical but raise very valid constitutional issues. So we have many avenues legally we're still pursuing and will pursue for Leonard, and if the courts take these seriously and give him the justice that is due, we firmly believe he should be released. But I'm one who's become somewhat jaded by our justice system, and while I feel strongly that our cases are strong, we need people to become outraged and basically stand up, and everyone who knows something about Leonard's case and knows Leonard's case inform 10 other people so that Leonard's case can become back into the news and that we can gather the support for Leonard, because Leonard is just not about Leonard. This Kafkaesque situation could happen to any of us, particularly as we see our civil rights dwindling under the current administration. I'm an attorney in Boston, and we've seen very much how misconduct by the FBI here in Boston. There was admitted misconduct during what was called the COINTELPRO era that supposedly ended, but if one looks at what continues to happen, has never really ended. And it's important for people to realize that this could happen to anyone. You could be set up and framed as a patsy and become a prisoner, and in this case, a political prisoner, based on false, fabricated evidence. I'll speak anywhere, any place for Leonard, and in particular, we need to educate the young. I've done many talks in colleges, and it is really quite a shame that many of our college students don't know who Leonard Peltier is. They don't know about Wounded Knee of 1973, let alone Wounded Knee of 1890. It's time that we reinvigorate the youth and let them know that the past is their present.
That was Barry Bachrach, attorney for Native American activist and federal prisoner Leonard Peltier. Contact the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee at area code 785-842-5774 or visit the committee's website at www.leonardpeltier.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.